This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think it's a fairly courageous move for the president to come out and say that we as a country have a moral obligation to act on climate change.
No nation can solve this challenge alone, not even one as powerful as ours. And that's why the final part of our plan calls on America to lead. Lead international efforts to combat a changing climate.
Did you see how they covered President Obama's recent big environmental speech on the Sunday political talk shows? No? That's because none of the Sunday morning shows discussed it at all. In spite of its paltry coverage on the major networks, the speech is being heralded by some environmentalists as historical, while others are critiquing the president for not going far enough. Today on Sea Change Radio, we do our part to make up for the network's deficient analysis of this important speech by talking with Alex Trembath of the Breakthrough Institute. The Breakthrough Institute is an American think tank interested in modernizing environmentalism for the 21st century. While their positions on nuclear power and natural gas have raised controversy in environmental circles, they're a leading voice on progressive ecological policy and how the government can advance innovation that promotes a healthy planet. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Alex Trembath. He's a policy analyst at the Breakthrough Institute. Alex, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Morning, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Alex, can you first give us a brief overview of President Obama's recent policy speech addressing climate change?
So President Obama's speech on Tuesday is something that we were actually pretty pleased about at Breakthrough, and that I think a lot of folks in the environmental community were pleased about. I think the keystone of his remarks was the announcement that his Environmental Protection Agency would begin to enforce the regulations that it's mandated to enforce on power sector greenhouse gas emissions from coal plants, from natural gas-fired power plants. This is something that we've expected since 2007 when the Supreme Court ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency had an obligation to pursue these regulations, but the actual practice of figuring out how you're going to regulate carbon emissions, about how you're going to do the rulemaking and write the regulations, has been a several-year process. So this is something we've been anticipating for a while, and something that was on sort of the back burner for climate advocates and for policymakers interested in addressing climate change. Something that was on the back burner when the cap and trade and carbon price debate was happening in Washington, since the major bills being forwarded in the House and the Senate would have preempted any EPA regulation on power sector emissions in favor of attaching a price to those emissions. But since the carbon pricing strategy failed in Congress, there has been a renewed interest in actually using that regulatory authority from the EPA to regulate emissions from the power sector. Other elements of the president's announcement on Tuesday included new efficiency standards for appliances and industrial processes and businesses to try and lower the energy intensity of economic activity and reduce the amount of energy necessary to produce economic benefit, and in turn lower the emissions associated with economic activity. And then some other components, including directing some authority of the Department of Energy Loan Guarantee Program towards fossil fuel energy innovation, things like carbon capture and sequestration. And we were relatively happy with all of that, mostly, I think, because over the last couple decades, the primary approach among advocacy and among policymakers to climate policy has been an attempt to do everything at once, to use huge sweeping policy mechanisms like a big international global treaty, or in the U.S., one cap and trade bill that would put a cap on all carbon emissions and then let the market figure it out from there. That approach hasn't worked, and we at Breakthrough have been talking for a while about how it's not a very promising approach. for a whole bunch of reasons, and that a more pragmatic approach that approaches the climate problem from multiple different angles, with multiple different policy mechanisms, from multiple different political motivations, is actually far more promising. What the president has called doing climate policy in chunks. And this is very this announcement that the president made is very emblematic of that much more pragmatic approach to climate policy that we were pretty pleased with.
Now, the Breakthrough Institute has taken some controversial positions in the environmental world. You're staunchly pro-nuclear, for example, and also you view natural gas largely in a positive light, but you're dead set against the expansion of coal. How do you view the president's approach to coal in his speech?
So the president's proposal on greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector is simply to follow up on the EPA's regulatory obligation to regulate pollution coming from coal plants, natural gas plants, and power plants that produce greenhouse gas emissions and CO2. How exactly those rules will be implemented will be decided over the next couple years as the EPA and regulatory authorities actually do the rulemaking and do the rule writing and figure out, well, are we going to use technology standards? Are we simply going to place a cap on the level of emissions, of CO2 emissions that one power plant can produce? Are we going to allow different states or different utilities to have a cap on their portfolio of power plants? There's a whole host of ways that you could actually implement the policies and implement the regulations that ultimately will seek to reduce total power sector emissions.
Aren't some of the president's, isn't his rhetoric a little bit redundant in terms of he's just enforcing the law? Aren't there already laws to do what he's claiming we're going to start doing? The EPA has a mandate to do this, but he's saying he's going to leave a lot up to the states as well. Mm-hmm. So how courageous is this?
I think it's a fairly courageous move for the president to come out and say that we as a country have a moral obligation to act on climate change, and we have the regulatory tools at our disposal. We have the regulatory authority at our disposal to do so. But we really have to, as an administration, he's saying, we really have to figure out how to implement those rules and how to best use those mechanisms and use that authority.
And to the president's credit, he is in a pretty tricky spot. I mean, we talk about the amorphous, quote unquote, environmental movement, but there's a lot of, it's highly fragmented. There's not one big, broad-based popular movement that's calling for him to do X, Y, or Z. Yes, there is right. A lot of hue and cry to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, and we'll get to that in a moment. But he's facing a lot of hostility from Congress and a lot of courts as well. So he doesn't really have this mandate to go out and to take the lead internationally in climate. But that is ultimately what he's saying in many ways, is that whole argument that unless India or China do that, we're going to lose the battle in the global economy, so we shouldn't do anything. That was kind of the Bush administration mm-hmm. policy, and one of the reasons why we didn't sign on to the Kyoto Treaty. Do you see this being a break from that kind of thinking?
I do see it as a break, and I think, honestly, the biggest factor has in making that break has been President Obama's courage has been important, his leadership both in the cap and trade debate and now in the pursuit of regulatory measures through the EPA. The president has shown important initiative. I think the other big factor, again, is cheap natural gas that makes it much easier to shift off of coal in the United States. And the other components of the president's announcements and of the president's energy and climate agenda have always been with an eye towards not just pollution reduction in the United States, but pollution reduction globally. You know, the other components that the president talked about on Tuesday and has talked about for years, really, were things like innovation in carbon capture technologies, innovation in renewables, innovation in nuclear technologies, using the very powerful innovation engine of the American federal government, of the Department of Energy, of the national labs, of the businesses and entrepreneurs in our country to make these technologies cheaper, to make them more scalable, and to make them sort of the first choice, not the second or third choice, of countries like China and India who are looking to raise their quality of life, to raise their economic standards, to to increase their energy access. And the way that they've done that historically and the way that they're doing it to date is through coal for the most part, through coal and gas and oil, which makes sense. Those are really great, abundant, cheap, energy-dense, transportable, storable fuels. They're tremendous fuels for powering growth in economies and energy infrastructures. And I think the president understands, and I think he's shown that he understands, that the way to make that shift globally is by making clean energy technologies cheaper, which is what happened in the U.S. with natural gas, which paves the way for regulations, and is what we think can and will happen with even cleaner technologies like renewables and nuclear in the long term. So we were pretty pleased to see the way the president is talking about climate and energy innovation in both an American and global context. And we think it's a very promising, pragmatic approach to the problem.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Alex Trembath. He is a policy analyst at the Breakthrough Institute. When you talk about cleaner technologies like nuclear and natural gas, a lot of my brethren in Japan, I lived there a long time, I know that the hair on their arms raises quite a bit when they hear about it being a cleaner technology. But one of the things that we did hear in the wake of Fukushima was that this was going to be the death knell for nuclear power. And then recently, Southern California Edison shuttered its San Onofre nuclear power plant, and once again, the headlines were, nuclear is dead.
Mm-hmm.
But you and your colleagues at the Breakthrough Institute see that differently. Why don't you explain?
So first of all, the death of nuclear globally has been greatly exaggerated. It turns out that while, yes, there have been troubles with the nuclear industry in the U.S. where we've lost 4 or 5 power plants in the last couple years, mainly due to high costs of maintaining and upgrading those plants. And yes, there was the Fukushima disaster in Japan a couple years ago, which is certainly not to be underestimated. Actually, there are over 20 countries right now pursuing or constructing nuclear plants in their borders or international cooperation on new nuclear. For instance, South Korea is helping to build 4 new nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia. So you put that all together, and there's something like 60 gigawatts of new nuclear just in construction around the world today, which is equal to over half of total U.S. nuclear capacity. And there is over 150 more gigawatts on top of that in planning around the world in countries like China and India and South Korea and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Turkey and Finland and even countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, who realize that to meet our climate goals and rely just on a subset of the zero carbon energy technologies, that's a limit that we don't need to place on ourselves. That's the first thing I would say about nuclear. The second is that, yes, we are seeing substantial challenges to the types of 20th century reactor designs that are dominant in the U.S. and around the world, but that there's actually a lot of potential for new reactor designs to launch and to get a grip in global markets that take advantages of modularization, that take advantage of standardization of design, that take advantage of economies of scale and learning by doing. In these new reactor designs, and a lot of new reactor designs also come with passive safety features that make it near impossible for them to melt down to the degree that a plant like Fukushima did. So we think that not only is the current death of nuclear greatly exaggerated, but that nuclear in particular, advanced and new nuclear reactor designs have great promise for providing plentiful electricity with zero carbon emissions for an increasingly energy-hungry planet.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Alex Trembath. He is a policy analyst at the Breakthrough Institute. People can go to thebreakthrough.org to learn more about their positions. So, Alex, you just laid out the case bullet point by bullet point for why you think that nuclear power still has a lot of legs in our nuclear, in our energy future globally. Take all those bullet points, if you will, and put them into the quote-unquote clean coal bucket for a second, if you will, because a lot of people would make that case that this technology is being developed and it's we have so much coal, and if we can just take this dirty energy and turn it into clean energy, we're all set. But it's not so simple, is it?
It's not simple. I wouldn't argue that any energy challenge is simple, especially when it comes to emerging and innovative technologies that we don't have a lot of experience yet, either in the lab or in the market. Clean coal cleaner coal that has carbon capture technologies affixed to it, where you capture the CO2 from the power plant and then either sequester it or put it to use in other industrial processes, is a very immature technology that we haven't really seen deployed at scale anywhere in the world, but that public agencies like the Department of Energy and countries, particularly like China, are pursuing pilot projects with a recognition of the fact that we have a lot of coal in the world. By the end of the decade, coal will regain its place as the number one producer of primary energy in the world after decades of dominance by petroleum and oil. So even if we do, as we hope to do, develop the cheaper, cleaner, zero carbon energy technologies in nuclear and renewables, we still have coal plants around the world, thousands of them, that are in operation and are relatively young. 75% of the coal plants in China are less than 7 years old, and coal plants are built to run for 40, 50, 60 years. That starts to approach the timescales where we really have to start worrying about running up on our atmospheric carbon emission concentration targets. So I think that carbon capture remains a strong innovation priority because coal is going to be with us for a long time, and in most cases, we'll want to displace it with zero carbon generation technologies as soon as possible. But where we can't, or where that proves too difficult or too expensive, then it makes a lot of sense to have carbon capture technologies as a backstop. And so we see a strong need for continued innovation, development, demonstration, and deployment of those technologies to make them cheaper, to make them more commercially scalable.
And in President Obama's climate change speech, he also set forth some efficiency goals. And that's one of the harder things to try to regulate and to put in place good policy surrounding in terms of using less energy. And that's one of the things that I get a little frustrated about reading when I hear about all these bridge fuels and cleaner instead of clean technologies, is why can't we just use less? Talk about what the president has set forth in terms of trying to reduce consumption and how the Breakthrough Institute views this issue.
So primarily, the president's proposals and the Department of Energy's work on energy efficiency and more energy efficient technologies have been aimed at making end-use consumption of energy more efficient. Things like more energy efficient light bulbs, more energy efficient appliances, air conditioners, refrigerators, heaters, more energy efficient industrial processes in manufacturing or synthetics or chemicals or buildings, which are a huge consumer of energy in the U.S. and around the world. So those are all great and worth doing, but it's worth looking back at history and recognizing that the world has always been getting more energy efficient, that the energy intensity of the economy, the amount of energy it takes to produce an extra unit of economic growth, has been on a pretty steady downward shift over more than the last century. And over that century, the total consumption of energy on the planet increased by a factor of 25. I would say that energy intensity and improvements and energy efficiency improvements are a major component of energy innovation, of reducing our emissions, but that even if you assume radical improvements in historical energy efficiency improvements, we're still going to have to triple or quadruple global energy consumption and production, which means you need much greater abundances of much cleaner energy if you want to accomplish that, if you want to give people the energy that they need and they want, and you want to do it without wrecking the climate.
Also, in President Obama's climate change speech, he set forth a plan dubbed the Federal Quadrennial Energy Review. And one of the pieces that's pretty exciting within that is that the federal government will be getting 20% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020, as long as it goes as planned. Right now, I think it's around 7%. That's pretty bold over a seven-year period. What does that mean? And can we use the federal government's template for the residential market eventually?
Absolutely. So the federal government turns out to be the biggest consumer of energy in the country. Not surprisingly, if you include military bases, if you include federal buildings, if you include federal vehicles, and all the infrastructure that it takes to maintain a developed world federal government. So the innovation and the forward-thinking progress on low-carbon technologies just in the public sector and just at the national federal level, it can actually be a massive laboratory and demonstration and deployment platform for new technologies that allow them to improve, that allow them to be scaled and gain market experience and market entrance, and it allows entrepreneurs and allows utilities and allows regulators to figure out how to integrate these new and emerging technologies into energy systems that will have, I think, very strong effects in residential, industrial, and transportation sectors outside the federal government. So we, and I think many others, were happy to finally see the president talking about a quadrennial energy review, which would be modeled after the Department of Defense's quadrennial defense review, which it's used for decades as a strategic plan that's done every 4 years to assess in the DoD with our defense investments, where we are with our technology investments. And so for the quadrennial energy review, it'll be an opportunity and an institutional opportunity to figure out every 4 years, what are our energy goals? What successes have we had in the last 4 years? What are our technology innovation goals? How are we pursuing decarbonization and energy security? These are big questions that have never been really asked in a formalized way and assessed in a structured way over long time periods. It's been much more boom and bust with these kinds of questions. So we're very pleased with the quadrennial energy review, and we'll be excited to see how it's implemented.
I know a guy that's got a lot to lose. He's a pretty nice fella, kind of confused. Got muscles in his head, ain't never been used. Thinks he owns half of this town. Starts drinking heavy, gets a big red nose. Beats his old lady with a rubber hose. Then he takes her out to dinner, buys her new clothes. That's the way that the world goes down. That's the way that the world goes round. You're up one day, the next you're down. It's a happening to water, you think you're gonna drown. That's the way that the world goes round.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to policy analyst from the Breakthrough Institute, Alex Trembath. Now, Alex, any discussion of the president and climate, I'm contractually obligated to mention the Keystone XL pipeline. He did say, and I'll quote from what he said here. He said, "Allowing the Keystone pipeline to be built requires a finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest, and our national interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution." The net effects of the pipeline's impact on our climate will be absolutely critical to determining whether this project is allowed to go forward. Now, he gave himself some wiggle room in that language because the significantly exacerbate the problem is kind of that. That's the key word. So how did you and your colleagues interpret the keystone element of President Obama's speech?
Well, I think that you are exactly right, Alex, that the president left himself considerable wiggle room in sort of offering a branch to environmentalists who have been protesting the pipeline without absolutely saying that he's going to approve the pipeline, or without rejecting their premise that Keystone has nothing to do with climate and that's all about international trade. But earlier this spring, the president's State Department already in their environmental impact assessment of the Keystone Pipeline found that the pipeline would not lead to a considerable increase in global carbon dioxide emissions than would a world where the pipeline wasn't built and that oil comes from somewhere else. So in terms of the Keystone Pipeline, I can understand why it has been useful to the climate activism community as an organizing symbol. The president has yes or no authority on the pipeline. He doesn't have to go through Congress. He doesn't have to jump through any regulatory hoops. He has the final word. And so Keystone has been offered, I think, as a litmus test for the president from climate activists on pollution.
As I reread that statement, it's pretty clear that it's going to pass when he said the State Department is going through the final stages of evaluating the proposal. And you mentioned how the State Department earlier argued that the Keystone wouldn't notably boost greenhouse gas emissions, but the EPA has come out with a completely different interpretation of that. And these are scientists, climatologists. State Department is not filled with climate scientists. They're looking at core national interests and energy needs, and their list of priorities is going to be rather different than what the EPA's are. And so the fact that the president is saying the State Department is going to be evaluating this proposal ultimately, I think that pretty much tells us where things are heading.
Yes, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right about that. And there is, as you said, this sort of internal conflict within the administration between the EPA and the State Department on the Keystone question. But even independent climate scientists find that the marginal extra carbon emissions from Keystone are really not that significant compared to total global carbon emissions. I think at best or at most, the extra carbon that you would emit in a world with the Keystone Pipeline as opposed to a world without the Keystone Pipeline amount to something like just 0.1 or 0.2% of the carbon emissions that climate scientists tell us we need to respect to stay within our climate goals by mid-century. So it's simply not that much carbon in a world where that carbon is probably going to be emitted anyway from oil from maybe elsewhere in Canada, from Venezuela, from Nigeria, from Russia, from China, from the U.S. So while it's been a relatively effective symbol in mobilizing activism, it hasn't been a particularly effective strategy, we think, for the much more important policy and technology imperative, which is developing alternative fuels to oil that will enable nations and enable businesses and enable industries not to want to pursue the tar sands in the first place.
He's a policy analyst at the Breakthrough Institute, Alex Trembath. Alex, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Freddie Hubbard, Herbie Hancock featuring the Chieftains and Lisa Hannigan, and John Prine.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.